This is KAYT, Gina, Alexandria. This is Gospel Radio at its very best. 88.1. KAYT, praising the Lord.
This is BJ, and I would like to welcome you to our show, Just Stuff. This show is about ordinary people just like you, just like me, combining our efforts in a positive way to make our community better, one day at a time, through conversation, encouragement, resources, empowerment, and just plain talk. Remember, you are the best part of this show. Last week, I interviewed Nicholas, and he graciously shared his story of addiction with us. Today, my guest is a certified addiction counselor, as well as a mental health professional. Her name is Kina, and she will enlighten us on the process of recovery. Drug use is horrible, especially among our youth. And I know that drug use has been around for a very long time, but it's getting worse. Maybe if we talk about it enough, someone will listen. Maybe someone will be affected in a positive way, and lives will be changed. Lives will be saved. Kina, I watched several videos on addiction and recovery, and it seems the primary reason for addicts refusing recovery is they haven't hit their bottom yet. Is that true?
You know, they talk about a bottom, but a bottom is different for everybody. You know, everybody's bottom is different. What happens in one person's life is not necessarily the thing that gets them to recovery, as in another person's life. I wouldn't say that they hadn't hit their bottom. That was an old saying that we said back in the days, because surely when you're an addict and you're a practicing addict, things are going on in your life that definitely, you know, demonstrate or that you should change your life. Mm-hmm. But it's not that easy for an addict. Mm-hmm. Because preferably your life become involved in getting, finding, and using drugs. Mm-hmm. And that becomes their life.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that being in a recovery is a huge accomplishment, and recovering addicts have a lot to be proud of. But does it remain a journey for the rest of their lives?
Yes, it is a journey. Recovery doesn't start until you are living in society, and you know, being acclimated back to the ways of society and following rules and regulations. Because in active addiction, you are not necessarily abiding by the law. You're not necessarily taking care of your family. You're not necessarily participating in community events and helping others and just being a productive family member.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the first step to recovery?
Honesty is the key to recovery. And just like in anybody's life, you know, you have to be honest with yourself in order to get better. And when we say honesty, it's being honest about the severity of your addiction, whether or not it's causing problems in your life, on your job, in your family. Mm-hmm. With law enforcement, mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, some individuals have mental problems as well as addictions. How difficult is it to treat individuals that have mental problems as well as addiction problems?
It can be challenging. However, for anyone that can get completely honest, recovery is possible. Basically, with a mental disorder as well as substance use disorder, the individual has to be stabilized or needs to be stabilized on their mental health medications. Sure. So in order to fully gain the potential from substance use classes and education, they work hand in hand.
Oh, okay.
So you can't treat one without the other.
Oh, okay.
They work hand in hand.
Okay. Now, we've heard so much in the news lately about, about opioid addictions, the opioid epidemic. And even when opioid addicts are no longer dependent, why is it they're at such a high risk for relapse?
Addiction centers in the brain, and it's basically a brain disorder. So when an individual has been living their life and dependent upon any substances, especially opiates, there is a phenomenal craving that comes. So we recommend that there's relapse prevention strategies that they participate in. Mm-hmm. And it's like you asked earlier about the journey, it's an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. You can do 28 days in a facility, but the journey's not going to begin until after you walk out that facility and you have to re-enter life and go on with your life. You have to have the self-care. You have to remember that you are addicted. And at some point, make sure that you're maintaining whatever strategies, whatever coping skills you've been taught,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to stay abstinent.
That's drug addiction takes along with it a lot of pressure, a lot of self-involvement.
Yes.
Anyway, now, how does counseling help recovering addicts learn to manage the things we face in everyday life, such as stress and social networking and all of the things that goes along with everyday life, aggravation and all of those things?
I see counseling as a good tool to helping people heal. Especially recovering addicts. You know, it's not everywhere you can go and you can have somebody to talk to that's willing to listen. Well, addiction counselors and other mental health professionals, they're trained. That's their job. And I'll tell you, this is a job that you have to have a love for to totally be effective. Because you are helping people restructure their lives. And the counselor's there to listen, as well as help teach them coping skills for dealing with. There may be anger issues, there may be relationship building, there are skills that you need to work on, alcohol and drug refusal skills, also craving escape skills. There's just tons and tons of things that ordinary people, or should we say normal people, as we say in the recovering world, normal people don't have to go through, because they can experience something and walk right through it. Whereas a person that is addicted to substances, it tends to follow them and they continuously bring it up and they have to relearn those skills.
Brain chemistry that you spoke of.
Yes, they have to relearn skills in order to deal with what we would call simple problems. Mm-hmm. However, mm-hmm. to a addicted brain, it's not as simple. Mm-hmm.
That's something. That's enlightening. It really is. Which is better, in your opinion, residential or outpatient therapy? And what's the specific length of time for inpatient treatment to provide an effective recovery journey?
You asked about residential or inpatient,
mm-hmm.
or is that outpatient?
Outpatient.
Residential,
yeah.
Treatment is basically where somebody stays for a length of time after they've gotten out of an inpatient facility, a 28-day to a 30-day program. And residential, you know, here in Alexandria and Pineville area, we had the Bridge House and we had the Phase 2 for women.
Mm-hmm.
They are no longer in existence, but there are other facilities in other areas that provide that extended length of care. Sometimes people just need a little bit of more time to be out of the area that they were actively using in, because if nothing changes, nothing changes. So a lot of times we need to get them away from their environment, because environment has a lot to do with mm-hmm. continued drug use. I think that they are both important.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the residential stays are from 30 to 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
However, outpatient, 18 months to 2 years.
Okay.
Can be an effective outpatient.
So and with the outpatient recovery, you go to meetings, you go to counselors, and those are the things that you do, or?
Peer support meetings as well. We recommend that you do a peer support meeting. Mm-hmm. Getting involved in other recovering communities, and that would be AA and NA that we recommend to find a sponsor and work with somebody who are actually working a 12-step program.
Oh, okay.
Now, everybody does not work a 12-step program, but those peer support meetings are very important,
mm-hmm.
very important.
Now, one question I want to ask you, and I have been wondering about this for a very long time, and that is, why is it some people can be around people that do drugs but never touch them? How is that possible?
Okay. I'm gonna have to relate back to something that I was taught. You know, there, and I do know some people who can take one drink and never drink again, you know? Or try a drug and say, well, it just didn't fit well with me. Or they had a bad experience and it just wasn't their cup of tea. However, I was taught about a predisposition to alcoholism or drug addiction, whereas you're genetically predisposed.
That's what a doctor told me one time, but I mm-hmm. still just really never understood it, because she said some people are just not wired that way.
Mm-hmm. Some people, the minute that drug or alcohol hit their body, it sets off that reward system, and they just love the way it makes them feel, and they said, okay, I found my miracle,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
mm-hmm.
they want that feeling. Other people are not, like you said, genetically wired
mm-hmm.
to have to become dependent, you know, and as you continue to use it, you continue to like that feeling that mm-hmm. it gives you, and our transmitters send signals to the receptors, and it's like, okay, I want that feeling again. And it's on and on and on and on.
That is just weird.
You know, we're all uniquely made.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's true. But that does answer my question.
Okay.
Now, what drug do you think is the hardest to recover from?
I don't know, that's a challenging question.
Because everybody's different,
everybody's
so it would be
different
for everybody, is that?
I see more challenges in treating alcoholism.
Really?
Yeah, because alcoholism, you know, you can walk in a store, any corner store, and buy alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, individuals don't see the problems that it caused
mm-hmm.
until they have gotten really severe, and because it's socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So convincing
and it's cheaper.
And convincing someone that they have a problem is a lot more difficult.
With an alcoholic.
Mm. Even with a DWI 1 or 2, they still may not be convinced that there's a problem, you know.
Well, how difficult is it to reach functioning addicts? And explain the difference. Explain what a functioning addict is for me.
At one time, I used to believe in functional addicts. However, I was taught that there's no such thing as a functioning alcoholic
oh, really?
And an addict. The only thing that differs, I believe, is the severity of the impairment, of the disease. Some people may only drink on the weekend, may only participate on the week, on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And on Monday morning, they get up and they go to their job. And we only see the outside. We don't know what the physical effects of that are,
True.
Because unless that individual is willing to share that, I really had a hangover and I had to go and find somewhere to lay down on my break from my job. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but literally, when they referred to functioning addicts, they were saying that those were people that could hold a job.
Right.
Still maintain their bills and the family.
Right, that's what I've heard.
Yeah. I can't say that I necessarily believe in that, but that's just me, and that's
mm-hmm.
personal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because even when you're on, if you're impaired, you're using something. Let's say housewives who are prescribed certain medications like Xanax.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the outcome,
True.
Until something really severe happens.
True.
So we have women that are picking up their children from school and driving these vehicles, and
they're
a lot. Mm-hmm. But they are considered functioning
mm-hmm.
because they're still able to maintain their daily routine
mm-hmm.
as well as get their medicines from the doctor. And unless there's an accident or unless they overdose, we don't see any problem in it.
Hmm. I tell you, that's something. Statistically, how much do addicts benefit from aftercare programs whenever go ahead.
Yeah, I would think that an addict has a much greater chance of remaining sober or abstinence if they participate in an aftercare program, because those programs are geared from 6 months to a year after the person has finished education, substance use disorder education.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say 75% to 80%.
Oh, okay. Okay. So it is really crucial
it
that
is
they
important.
Stay in aftercare.
It's a part of the
recovering mm-hmm. process. Okay. What part does peer pressure play in drug abuse in teens and young adults, you think?
I believe that peer pressure has a lot to do with teenagers using drugs. Because you're always wanting to, as a young teen, I can relate to wanting to be one in the crowd.
The in crowd.
Yes. And even though we've been taught that we should not indulge in alcohol, because kids drink alcohol,
mm-hmm.
We're more pressured to do so when we're around our peers.
To show off.
And just to be accepted.
To fit in.
They want to be accepted
mm-hmm.
and to fit in, like
mm-hmm.
you said.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that would be highly influential in a child's life.
So what's the difference between recreational drugs and being addicted?
Recreational drugs and being addicted is similar to also what you would call a
functioning.
But in recreational drug use, and it normally happens, a lot of times it happens in early teens
mm-hmm.
For most people, that you're going to football games and, you're going to parties or just some kind of social event, and there may be some drugs involved. And they don't necessarily do it all the time. That's not every weekend situation. However, an addicted person, their whole life evolves around getting, using, and finding drugs.
I Tell you, this problem is haunting. And you wonder what you can do about it. But the thing is, it's getting worse.
It is.
And especially
worse
among our young people.
And I've been seeing even the younger generation are indulging in the opioid use. And it's devastating to see young people that are so strung out on drugs. You would think that there was something else that they could be doing.
Right.
You know. And for some.
But that you know, not knowing yourself, not knowing your worth, not having a relationship with God, it allows these things to come in, and it's just so important for, you know, teenagers, for anybody to just, you know, love God, love yourself, and know your worth.
Yes.
Because you're worth something. You don't have to just do that. You know, you just, I'm at a loss for words sometimes because, you know, you hate to see that. But, you know, by the same standard, you just don't hardly know what to do about it.
It's mind-boggling.
It really is.
It really, really is. And a lot of times in the field that I'm working with now, in the criminal justice system, a lot of the addicts we don't get to see until they become involved in the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And surely many of them have had problems long before.
And then you think sometimes when you talk, they don't listen, you know, and it's
they become hopeless.
And I mean, this is real. It's not a plaything. This is real. Being addicted to drugs and, you know, not being able to stop, that's real. Because I've had addicts to tell me, I remember one time a little guy told me, he said, "Miss Barbara," he said, "I know that it's wrong. He said, I know that it's destroying my family. He said, but I just can't stop."
There's nothing he could do about it without help. It's too much for us. You have to get help for that. And it has to be identified.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be willing to accept the help.
Do you think sometimes people are embarrassed to admit an addiction and not get help because of the embarrassment?
Of course. Especially in lots of dysfunctional families, we're taught not to talk, you know, not to say anything. You don't discuss how you feel. You don't show emotions. And they tend to medicate those feelings with drugs.
Mm.
They self-medicate those emotions.
And I think my next question was going to be about how families are destroyed by this disease, but you know, we've already touched on that. But what is the most profound piece of knowledge in regard to conquering addiction from your experience? What's the most profound piece of knowledge?
When you say profound, do you mean the what's most worthy?
Mm-hmm.
I would just have to say that there is hope after dope. You know, everybody that finds their way.
Dope.
Yeah, there is everybody that finds their way into addiction. There is a way out. You know, of course, it's about prayer, meditation, as well as seeking the resources. And it's so important to have resources for people, you know, to have a place where they can walk in and say, "Look, I'm tired, I'm beat up, I don't want to do this anymore." We don't have a lot of places like that anymore. We really don't, and we need more places like that. We need more people that are willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of our religious organizations, they're open on a Sunday, but we still have other days throughout the week.
So what is the difference? Because I know a lot of the addicts have family members that don't set boundaries for them. So what is the difference between helping and enabling? Because a lot of times the family members, and it's because of the love that they have for their children or their person that they're helping, sometimes they think that they're helping by the things they do, but they're actually enabling that person to, you know, for a downhill slide.
Yeah. Well, this, like I said, this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And without help, it's too much. Also, it's a family disease. Mm-hmm. When an individual in the family, you know, is addicted, it affects everybody in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because the family has to adjust their roles to make up for this individual who has issues.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you don't exactly know when. A lot of times you don't know exactly when it is time to throw in the towel, because what mother or father is going to want to give up on their children?
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that. So there are programs at the AA facilities and NA facilities. They have, they call it
Al-Anon.
And it helps to teach families about what they can do. You know, the difference between enabling and helping.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you don't know when it is time
right.
to seek help for mm-hmm. your individual. A lot of times you may want to. There's interventions you can have. I can remember some of the judges stepping in, city judges years ago, they would step in with families and do some interventions,
mm-hmm.
you know, and kind of coerce the addict to sign paperwork with an addictions counselor being there, and they could go over to, it was APODAC back then,
mm-hmm.
and they would get outpatient treatment.
Really?
I don't know if a lot of that is, or how much of that is going on now, but surely there are a lot of agencies, a lot of mental health agencies, behavioral health,
mm-hmm. okay.
that are seeing some of these children and are referring them to substance use disorders.
Now, what are the telltale signs of addiction? Or is there any telltale signs of addiction?
We know our family members better than anybody else. So we see them. We know when they start slacking at home, if they always come in and they're tired, and their eyes are bloodshot, the pupils are dilated. Of course, with the marijuana, they get the munchies and want to eat up everything in the house. Always wanting money. Can't hold a job. Sometimes they're even angry. They start confusion within the home when there's basically no need. But a lot of times it's about, they make it about them because they're needing money or they're upset. And
mm-hmm.
surely everybody knows their family members. You can tell when there's a change.
Mm-hmm.
But the signs are totally different. Because with opioids, there's a lot of nodding going on. They can be sitting, having a conversation with you.
There are some new kids on the block in the Sonya Quarters, and they're opening up a recovery, no limit for recovery. And it's going to be something like you're talking about. It's going to be a place for addicts to go and get help, and then they're going to have children that can come out of the neighborhood into that place as a place of solace, because they don't have to